Welcome to Podcast on Fire 119. The episode is called The Moss, and I am Kenny B. And with me, as usual, is Tom KW. Say hi.
Hello, everyone.
And we also have a person who lately has been called the likes of a fuckable lover and a motherfucker. And that's the kind of actual love. It's actual love that Hong Kong Dave has received lately. So say hi.
Hello, everyone.
Strangely profane love from Stuart and Tom KW. Coke-induced and alcohol-induced love, but love nonetheless. So how do you feel, Dave, about that? I'm printing that on my business card. I won't go profane on you just yet. I haven't thought of a suitable... what can I do to add to the fire, so to say? The podcast on fire. Anyway, this is Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network. The Anki Show. The website located at podcastonfire.com. Contact information, email, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. We're also reachable on our message forum, podcastonfire.com/forum. There you'll find the members-only archive of cut conversation and exclusive movie reviews and content. And we also have exclusive content available on the website in the form of bonus episodes done about free up until this point, and more in the pipeline. We are also on Facebook. Like us on our fan page, facebook.com/POF Network, and also join the ongoing discussion in our discussion group. No firm URL, so just type in Podcast on Fire Network in the Facebook search box and you'll find us, and we'll add you as soon as you just request that. And we're also on Twitter, twitter.com/podcastonfire. Me, Kenny B, I do my writing on SoGoodReviews.com, and those main reviews are video reviewed in small little bite-sized videos. That's LizzyKVideo.com. Latest main review at the time of recording is the Hong Kong Black Magic horror movie Red Spell Spells Red, which is from the makers of Centipede Horror. So it's a nice little double bill that, you should say. You could say they didn't really make a third distinct creepy crawler flick, I believe, because in Red Spell Spells Red there's mostly scorpions, so it should have been scorpion horror in reality. But it's a cool ass little movie, and it's all good fun. I'm also on Twitter, twitter.com/SoGoodReviews. Rate and subscribe the Podcast on Fire Network on iTunes, and stream us on the go with Stitcher. Download that from stitcher.com to your computer as well as to the various smartphones out there. And if you want to add us, just type in Podcast on Fire Network, and the advantage there is that you can add each of the shows individually, so you don't add all the shows in one huge chunk, which is good and neat. So that's the main stuff, and we'll let Hong Kong Day talk about what's going on Hong Kong Gig Guide.
Yeah, a couple of developments since last time. I finally got a couple of gigs I can go to when I'm out there. Got the first two of those, which is great fun. One of the best local bands called Noughts and X's going the alternative funding route for their next CD. So I think the website is, I think, Kickstarter. I think they're doing like a funding, you know, funding drive on that.
Yeah, that's the that's how Kickstarter is kind of structured. Like, if there's Pledge Music out there, of course, and there's Kickstarter for various stuff that you want to fund, and you get sort of rewards depending on the level, how much you actually contribute and fund, so to say.
Yeah, I've put in a bit on behalf of the Gig Guide, $50, which gets me like a advanced download and signed physical CD.
Right on.
So I've got full details of that on the Gig Guide. So if you know people want to pop along and take a look and have a listen to their stuff, see if they like it.
And this is on Facebook. If you didn't know, listeners, this is on Facebook. So just type in Hong Kong Gig Guide in the Facebook search box as well.
Yeah, they've only, as of recording, they've been running it maybe 3 or 4 days. They've got a target of, I think, 10,000 US, and they're about 3.5 last time I looked.
Right.
So cool. they're doing pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah, we'll make sure to link to that as well, that Kickstarter campaign. So that's all good fun. Any developments over at thecinemashow.com in terms of your reviews, Tom KW?
Just prepping, ready to unleash my Ip Man 2 review, which I'm working on for also. So that hopefully should be up soon. Yeah, probably this week sometime, depending on their schedule over there. But yeah, keep your eyes peeled for that.
Cool. And late plug that I found out over the weekend. We talked a little bit about forcesofgeek.com and that Big Mike Leader is doing articles quite frequently over there. And the latest one that he posted is called Foo Action Revisited. That's PHOO. And to quote the opening of the article, rather than me explaining poorly what the actual Foo Action Revisited means. Quote, "The last few years have seen British genre television make a hell of a return. The BBC's rejig of Doctor Who saw the show return bigger and better than before, crossing over from cult success of the original to mainstream success. Subsequent genre shows like Life on Mars, Ashes to Ashes, Sherlock, and Being Human have continued with that success. But for every winner, there's a loser. A show that never got past the pilot of a handful of episodes. One show that didn't get the opportunity to develop past its pilot was the wild and wacky Foo Action, based upon Tank Girl and Gorillaz artist Jamie Hewlett's comic strip Get the Freebies. The pilot premiered at the same time as Being Human's original plot and featured a high-kicking kung fu hero clad in a yellow and black tracksuit, a teenage anarchist named Whitey Action, Apollo Creed himself, Carl Weathers, the royal family, basketball herded bad guys, a 7-foot-tall purple gorilla, masked Mexican wrestlers, Hong Kong legend Richard and did we mention the Buddhist Pants of Destiny?" End quote. This is a show that unfortunately stayed at that only. And Mike Leader takes a look back at the production that he was involved in of the pilot and what could have been, why it didn't quite gel, but it's not a bitter look back and as such. And two clips are in the piece as well, including a little bit of Carl Weathers' participation in this, which looked fun, very relaxed and all of that. So in short, is this I mean, the shows you've heard of, but is the comic strip anything you're familiar with? Get the Freebies?
I'm familiar with the creator, but I'm not aware of that one.
Nope, same here, yeah.
It's the guy that worked with Damon Albarn on Gorillaz, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is a great style in itself, if you look at Gorillaz only. I mean, Tank Girl, I saw the movie once upon a time, and I like that. I was kind of in love with Lori Petty. I thought she was very sexy in Tank Girl. I don't know if that was a good actual comic adaptation as such, but it looked like wild fun, originally anyway, based on the spark that was in the movie anyway. The mid-90s comic adaptation, Malcolm McDowell playing the bad guy, I think. So that's all linked in the show post. Forcesofgeek.com is the website, but we'll link to the actual article as well in the show post. So moving on to some brief network updates. Brief one to let you know again what we've done this and the week before that, and what's in sort of in the immediate pipeline. And it really has been like fairly frequent recordings lately. We have in the can this week in Sleaze 7, Tidy Whitey Theater, the debut of Tidy Whitey Theater. And me and Josh, the Lord, Great Lord, Josh Regal, did dual reviews of Kidnap and Sentence to Hang, which is the latter one is the first Hong Kong movie to get a Category 3 rating, and the movie we did first is the movie it's a remake of. It's a Shaw Brothers drama from 1974. Release date of that show is not determined yet. It's in the pipeline. The last episode of Podcast on Fire, 118, featured the return of Stu. Featured him swearing up a storm, but bring in the Stu energy that only he can. And I in all seriousness, I've missed that so much. You know, you're doing great, guys, but And I as a host, I know I'm lacking compared to Stu in terms of energy. He has, you know, he's sharp and he has a wit, and he's it's chaos, yeah, but it's great chaos to have Stu on the show sometimes, because it's hella fun. It's that mix of info and fun, and it all generated a fantastic chat on John Woo's Hardboiled. You know, we had information in there, but a light chat and a informative chat nonetheless. So it was all good fun. And a few days ago, it's actually about a week now, we all three recorded the Director Series 4 on Namnai Choice, The Ghost Snatchers and Killer's Nocturne. And we're probably about halfway point in terms of looking at the director Namnai Choi. And it's great. It's great to have this coverage of this highly regarded director that people actually don't really know. They know movies, but not necessarily the name, which is, again, the sort of mission statement of the director series. And as for the release date, that'll be announced soon, or we'll just put it up. And without any announcement, so just keep an eye out bi-weekly on Wednesdays normally for the special shows that aren't podcast on fire, so to say. Various stuff being worked on, including a new commentary and new shows, including I've made the decision that the Taiwan Cinema Podcast is going ahead without IFD on Fire sort of transforming into it. I think I can start it before IFD on Fire. Because these Taiwanese movies were presented by IFD at some during some point. That's why I link IFD and Taiwan Cinema that way. But I've decided to go ahead with it. And I got some help to find another name other than Taiwan Black Movies for the show. Taiwan Black Movies is the name of the documentary I'm reviewing for the first show. But I wanted the name. I think it's a great name. But I found it cheap to just blatantly steal it that way. So thanks to some brainstorming on our Facebook group, A Hero Never Dies gave us Taiwan Noir, which nice. I kind of fell in love with. I like it. So I've written an introduction, and I'm probably going solo on at least the first show, and we'll see if I can find some co-hosts on it. We'll see. I want to go ahead and get it done. I want to add it to the network, so we'll keep you posted on that one. So, network updates. Done. Last movies watched initiated. So why don't we go ahead with Tom KW's viewing habits of late?
Okay, I managed to get in Investigator Andy and the Secret of the Ghostfire, aka Detective Z and the Mystery of the Phantom Flame, from I think 2010. Obviously directed by Shuai Hark and starring Andy Lau. First I'll say it's probably the best technical experience I've had with a film on Blu-ray to date. Managed to rent the Blu-ray, and yeah, the CineAsia Blu-ray is gorgeous. The sound is amazing, and all in all, I really wish the film had been a bit better, seeing how well it kind of looked on Blu-ray. The film itself, the plot is kind of, it's a bit convoluted, it's a bit messy. By about halfway through, it was really starting to kind of annoy me, and aside from being so drawn out to the point of irritation, it pretty much has nothing to do with any type of detective work, aside from some very minor scenes involving the kind of the science behind a murder weapon. But it focuses too much on some, you know, pretty ridiculous but entertaining to a point fight scenes and some very lush cinematography, which yeah, really kind of the Blu-ray helped. But at 2 hours, you know, I'm sorry, Harky, but your film looking and sounding beautiful cannot save it from being so just incoherent and just so messy. I mean, thumbs down from me, but I really wish it had been better. Also, Richard Ng transforms into Teddy Robin for no apparent reason about halfway through the film.
But that's a good reason. It should be
good reason
illogical
itself.
Or not. I mean, Richard Ng and Teddy Robin in the same movie is still sort of valid and not out there, something weird, but still in there, rather. And I remember Chorhawk spoke of it was a good experience to still have those guys around in the interview that we he did for this very website, talking about the production of Detective D. So it warms my heart that they're still out there and doing good work.
Yeah, definitely the fanboy in me was really happy to see him, even though it was quite brief. But yeah, I mean, I really wish he'd been so much better. But I think the title's a bit misleading because it's really kind of a martial arts film, because I mean, the plot is kind of, it's a bit messy for what it is, and a bit incoherent at times, but it's really kind of only touched upon every so often throughout the film. You know, really, it's kind of a collection of fight scenes, some good, some bad, most of them quite, you know, entertaining for what they are. But yeah, I mean, I think the plot could have been so much better. Tony Lung-Koff, I also makes an appearance in it, which I didn't realise, which was just nice to see him as well. Plays quite a major...
You didn't realise because you didn't know, or didn't you recognise him? Or
no, I didn't know, I just didn't know. Because with me personally, I like to hear certain bits and pieces about films, maybe a star, or maybe kind of what the brief synopsis is, but I don't really like to kind of get too involved, because I think it almost spoils a film. I like to kind of go into films a bit, you know, kind of fresh, and sure. You know, I don't even watch a lot of trailers, really. Like, I like to kind of just see, especially Hong Kong trailers, Jesus, like 4 minutes, including the end of the film.
Yeah, that's old school. I hope they're not still doing spoilerific trailers as such, but I can agree, I don't think I like... you know, maybe 1 out of 10 trailers I watch, regardless if it's Asian cinema or not, kind of gets me. Ooh, I just dislike trailers nowadays. I think, yeah, I'll decide when I watch the movie. So trailers don't do anything for me in terms of luring me in. Out of all films that did kind of lure me in was, two really, non-Asian specific. Ted, the Seth MacFarlane movie with the talking teddy bear with Mark Wahlberg, looked great. Yep. And on the other side of the scale, what was it? A British movie. Either it was called Dinosaur or Tyrannosaurus, but it's not a dinosaur movie.
Paddy Considine's directorial debut.
Yeah, looked awesome. Yeah. Dark drama.
Yeah.
So those are examples. 2 out of 10. So.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I tend to mostly from information, minor reviews, you know, people kind of in our community speaking about them. I'm really not a person who's kind of sits and watch trailers, because I just don't like to see scenes I'm about to see. I'd rather go in completely fresh and see the scenes in in sync and in the context of the film, rather than kind of separate from the film themselves. So yeah, I wish you'd been better. It was a nice experience on Blue. I mean, it was absolutely beautiful. Probably, I'd say the best experience I've had so far in terms of kind of actually feeling and kind of being excited by Blue and kind of what it has to offer. But yeah, I just wish it had been a bit of a better film.
And there's going to be a prequel, I think, at this point, or a sequel, or maybe both. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Anything else you want to mention?
No, that's me, mate. That's all done. Yep.
Right on. Move on to Hong Kong Dave. Fuckable lover, Hong Kong Dave.
my last film watched was Carl Becker's 1978 film Dirty Tiger, Crazy Frog.
Oh, yeah.
With Lau Kar-wing and Sammo Hung. I much prefer Odd Couple to this, but there is plenty to enjoy here, particularly when the action dominates proceedings. I mean,
it's the same main cast in The Odd Couple, Lau Kar-wing and Sammo Hung.
Yeah, it's same duo. So many familiar faces on display here as well, from our old friend Jason Pei-Pew to Meng Hui, Yun Biu, Mars, Dean Shek, and lots more, including a very young Lam Ching Ying. The story's pretty basic. It's not, you know, unheard of in the traditional martial arts films. And here it's all about the repeated theft and acquisition of a metal chain-link vest known as Invincible Armor.
Mm-hmm.
Lau Kar-wing directed Odd Couple, and so naturally enough there's a greater emphasis on the action, which is almost certainly why I prefer it, you know, that and the kick-ass weapons work on that film.
Oh yeah.
It's still a fun film, but it's not one I watch rewatch frequently. But it's if you like traditional films, you might well enjoy watching this.
Integrating comedy in it as such. I mean, with Dean Shek there, there's bound to be a disaster in the making.
Yeah, not quite as fun as he was in Odd Couple, though. Was it Mr. Rockin or something on that?
I haven't seen Old Cobble, actually. So,
he plays his character called Mr. Rockin'. He's got like a really odd, bizarre like theme song. It's, you know, every time you see him on screen, there's this little tune that follows him about, and he kind of walks around like he's, you know, been hit with a taser or something. It's just really quite peculiar.
I mean, having said that, it sounds like I'm totally down on Dean Scheck, but I'm down with Dean Scheck on occasion as well. You know, it's not 50-50, but sometimes it is pretty funny. It kind of works because it's so out there.
Yeah.
Warriors 2 works because it's so out there, him pissing his pants during the final fight scene. And, you know, his insistence on being that out there. And it turns out he can scrap to a comedic degree. I mean, he can be quite physical despite being a comedic character in various movies. So I do like Dean Scheck, but not at all times.
No, especially not in Better Tomorrow 2.
It's the first movie I ever saw him in, and I never connected him to him in Better Tomorrow 2 to all those comedic performances until years later, because older, and it was just so different. I mean, it took some time to recognize him in particular, I guess, due to him not being a favorite as such. You know, Better Tomorrow 2 was fine when I once saw it. It's pretty melodramatic though, but it's okay.
Yeah, it's just him really, the problem I have with the film, I think.
It was amazing how young Lam Ching Ying looked in this, because I think at this point he's probably mid-20s, but he always kind of looked pretty young for his age anyway. So
yeah, look at Mr. Vampire. You know, he's supposed to be an old master. He looks so glued on, all those grey hairs and eyebrows. It took a few years as the Taoist priest and therefore him getting into his mid-30s, I guess, for him to look kind of in tune with the role. But Mr. Vampire in particular, it looks like they glued this stuff onto a kid. It's great. It works, of course, but it's noticeable.
But yeah, here this is like 1978, is maybe mid-20s, and he looks even younger. He looks like, you know, he could be like a teenager or something. You know?
He's still in the Big Boss. Nice. It looks even younger in the Big Boss. He's not a kid in the Big Boss as such, you know. But is, you know, we're talking 1971, 72 there, so he was around.
Is that the one where Mars plays a potato as well, David? Or is it Odd Couple?
I don't know. I definitely recognise him. She's got that really distinctive looking, face. But
yeah,
it's just there's so many people. It's like, oh, it's that guy, and oh, it's that one, and just a whole host of people you've seen in films like time and time again. So it's hard trying to keep up with it.
Oh yeah, of course,
definitely.
Right on. Any other movie?
No, just the one.
Okay, I'll mention a handful just briefly, run through them. With my viewing habits are very, scattershot and random, because I have tons of movies on portable hard drives. So I'll just look through a title list. Oh, why not that one? You know, not any extensive research beforehand. Just pick one, and most of the time there are movies you can't do any research beforehand with anyway, because they are so obscure. So, going through them. Wolf of Revenge. Gang War, and the main character's wife appears as a ghost to sell this action movie as a piece of family melodrama as well. A Taiwanese movie, I should say, this is. It's very eager, though. It never lets up, and it's almost wall-to-wall fights and gunplay, which is great to have, despite some of it being poorly staged, but overall, the energy shines through brightly, and the willingness to go all out with squibs and pyrotechnics, with stuntmen very much being in the midst of all this, is infectious. And then they have a ghost plot in the middle of it too. Genius. So, thumbs up eventually. Not a trek at all to get through. And then you move on to The Son of Dragon. I don't know if this is necessarily Hong Kong or Taiwanese, but anyway, definitely dull and complex triad affairs and family melodrama, where the family melodrama is about the fear of more children in the family, rather grown-up children, are going to end up in the gangster world, possibly. And but it has some sparks, and thanks to all-round in front of the camera and behind the scenes force, Adi Sung, who directed this movie and wrote it and starred it. The drama and all of that is stiff, but if you focus solely on the action, which he directed as well, that reveals promising sparks. In particular, two sequences, starting with a parking garage fight, which doesn't skimp on the power. And Adi Sung, who is one of the other kind of it might sound offensive, but for the sake of it, one of the other like cross-eyed characters in Hong Kong cinema, but not necessarily one of the comedic ones. He played more straight, slightly harder roles compared to To Siu Ming and what have you. But he has chops, and he has great stuntmen with him to deliver a pretty good little parking garage fight. And then later on, he plays a triad boss eventually who's on the run. And at the end, he's running through a mall and blasting away cops with a major shotgun. And there's, squibs are loaded up quite nicely, It's quite compelling, that sequence, because it's very tense, too. So in terms of action, the Son of Dragon delivers, but you have to wade through definitely dull and complex triad affairs that you don't care about. So watch it for that if you can find it. The Crippled Master. No, not the Crippled Avengers from Shaw Brothers. The Crippled Master, a movie that followed in the wake of the Crippled Avengers. But this one uses actual disabled performers for its above-average kung fu cinema exploit. Not exploitation. Because it doesn't exploit or belittle its main two performers, one of which doesn't have any arms and the other one has no usage of his legs. Rather the filmmakers have sat down to make sure these performers are used to the best of their abilities. Structure the action after this, and it's above standard despite it being a revenge tale essentially, and it's quite grisly the way the characters are obviously lose their arms and legs. One gets the arms hacked off and all of that, they're grisly enough. The other one has acid poured over his legs, so they essentially corrode away, and that's pretty nasty stuff, man, for a kung fu movie. Which is light on comedy, low on comedy, thankfully. And then these two meet the yoga master, revenge follows, but thankfully the choreography is very solid. It's very intricate from these guys to the main guys, as well as the performers around them as well. And, it's creative in the way it uses its, so to say, limited performers. And they got cast in like two or three other movies based on a trend, and then just sort of faded away in terms of feature movie credits anyway. So I do like it. They got a stateside release by New Line Cinema later on, maybe as late as the 90s, because the Laserdisc was put out in the 90s, so it got seen in US theaters by distributed by a sort of larger company rather than a little company picking it up for video or what have you in America. So it had something to, I think it's a fairly popular movie. Okay, last movie is watched down, and the episode is called The Moss, and therefore, after a little break, we are going to talk about The Moss, the movie that Hong Kong Dave chose for us. So, stick with us, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, and the main review for this episode is 2008's The Moss, and Hong Kong Dave picked that for us, so I'll let Hong Kong Dave talk about the movie and its plot.
Yeah, I've adapted the plot slightly from yesasia.com, and here goes. It's Jen, Sean Yu, is one of the many dirty cops working in Sham Shui Po. He's really more like a gangster than a cop, self-serving and living aimlessly in this hellhole of an area. He constantly has dealings with the mob and offers protection to the prostitutes in exchange for sexual favours. Of all the girls he fancies, Lulu, Bonnie Jean, most. He finds her non-inquisitive and quiet nature comforting, almost like a place where he can seek solace. Jen's routine is disrupted when the son of godmother Chong, played by Susan Shaw, goes missing in a rival gang's territory, headed by Four-Eyed Tong. The son disappears with a valuable green gemstone that was meant as a birthday gift. Jen is given the task by Chong of confronting Tong, played by Liu Kai-chi. Then the mysterious beggar, Fan Xu Wong, makes an attempt to kill Tong. That's the plot in a very basic sense. The Moss is written by Clement Cheng and was Derek Kwok's second film after The Pie Dog And he went on to make Gallants with the aforementioned Clement Cheng. Then made Frozen, and is now working on Stephen Chow's latest film, Odyssey. I have something of an attachment to The Moss, as it was the only Hong Kong film in general release during my 2008 visit there. I saw it twice while I was there. One with the famous Gang of Film, the love Hong Kong film Gang of Film, at the notorious Dynasty Theatre in Mong Kok. And once at the...
Why is it notorious? Explain that. I've never gotten the joke. Is it a shitty cinema or a great cinema?
It's not the best, but, you know, constant sort of speculation as to how it manages to remain open despite not having the biggest, biggest audiences.
Are there, like, buckets on the floor to, like, gather the rainwater and...
It looks fairly warm, but it's not quite that bad. You know, there's still kind of speculation as to who the ownership might be. You know, it's, okay. It's kind of like that. second time, I saw it at the equally notorious China Kim Cinema, which at the time was being renovated. It was quite an experience to see a film of this nature in a screen that had half the seats blocked off with plastic seating, scaffolding, building materials, plastic buckets and, bags of cement sort of stacked up in the aisles, So, it quite worked, actually. It kind of suited the atmosphere. So
it's a true 4D experience, man. But, you don't need to scratch to get sort of the smell of construction and... I don't know, smell of the city. It's in there.
Yeah, it was really, quite odd, but it's quite effective for that. The thing with the China Kim cinema, it's another cinema where it's not the best, and they literally show films like through the night. You left screenings kind of starting at about half four in the morning, so and it's in Tsim Sha Tsui East, which is another sort of kind of fairly notable. District for those within Hong Kong who work odd hours, if you know what I mean. So
it's traffic police.
Yeah, that's the one. it's quite. I saw it twice when I was there, but I wouldn't go so far as to call it an all-time great or anything. But it's for me a strong, characterful. Genre entry that does bear repeat viewings.
Mm-hmm. So. Right, so if we move on to your brief views initially, Tom?
Yeah, that was a fairly solid, no-frills drama. I mean, I did like the kind of scummy underworld feel to the film. Just really solid.
Yeah, I think solid is a good way to summarize it for me as well. Serviceable for new director Derek Kwok. It is a step down from Pie Dog. I really dug Pie Dog, which had kind of similar themes. It seems like Derek seems to like fairy tales, to feature fairy tales in the background, as symbolism connected to the main events in the movie. Which is not as pretentious as you might think, actually. It's something I noticed when watching both of these, actually. So it's not something that you need to sort of get the movie, but because it's fairly straight, despite. And so it's just a minor mention to have in there. Ultimately, it is about people, looking for connections and a breath of air from the world they're in, because this is a humid world. Hong Kong is humid. It just seems so hot and humid and sweaty, and just it's hard to get a breath of fresh air in this world, it seems. So it's seriously an intent, despite Derek Kwok having fun playing with how he sets part of the plot in effect, via the gemstone that is shut out of Ho Sai-man's ass. Ho Sai-man is one of the obese kids from Hollywood, Hong Kong, by the way.
Yeah.
And it's a quirky trigger for the story. Poop it out! So do you think that works, guys? Quirky setup and then it sort of turns all serious?
In part, I mean, parts of it don't quite kind of hang together, but...
I didn't know what I was getting in for.
You kind of go along with it. I mean, I wonder how Hosei Man's agent sold in the role, you know. you'll fight a gem, you'll fight a gem out of your ass and get beaten almost to death with a huge ornamental cock.
Well, he does get quite an explicit sex scene with the prostitute, yeah. Where they oil each other up and shit like that. So, you know, it's a rather racy, it's pretty racy start this, but it never not racy for it to be a category 3 movie though. There's always some nudity you can feature in Cat 2B, if this was indeed Cat 2B. Let's see, yes, it was. You know, I don't mind that, and it's kind of it's kind of a fascinating world in a way. And if looking at Sean Yu, you know, he's become part of the world and kind of gangsterish. You know, he hangs out with gangsters, and then you know, despite being a cop, you know, he's not a corrupt cop as such, but he's flowing with the world. You know, you know, he goes to massages, he goes whoring, you know, as the term always is, as they always translated as. And, you know, it's not like, as we set up when we talked about the movie, that he doesn't want to find anything else. But obviously, you know, the relationship with the Bonnie Sin character allows for that breath of fresh air a little bit. You know, they want to, you know, find some normalcy. I think there's a small piece of dialogue where he asks her, you know, you want to take a walk with me someday, and to them that's kind of an alien concept, you know, because they're so deeply immersed in the world. And now that little sister, I guess, to Bonnie Sins has arrived from the mainland, I assume, to be sold as well, you know. Now that plot is set into effect. And I don't know, within all this, it sounds like a busy plot. Which, yeah. As a matter of fact, I think Derek keeps a fair focus on all of these strands. Even though I personally didn't care about every strand. For instance, Susan Shaw, you know, looking for her son and making sure you know, you gotta find that son or else I'll beat you up or whatever. That one I didn't care about, but so... If we turn to you, Tom, do you think it was enough, or did you think everything played into each plot well? You know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I felt sometimes it was all a bit convenient that these characters come together and all have these dramatic ties, kind of all in the same kind of area. You know, there's a lot going on. It all seemed convenient at times. I mean, it felt slightly forced, but not enough to completely take me out of the film. But I think, as you said, Ken, I don't think there was enough effort made for the audience to like any of the main leads. I mean, apart from the little girl and arguably Fancy Wong's character, she was probably really the only character I sympathised with. So when the first real dramatic scenario occurs, not spoiling anything, but the series of events involving Sean Yu's character, the hobo with a handgun, and the Tong character, I didn't really invest into it emotionally until she was involved and everything else around her, kind of her certain plot line. It like some key violence and obviously some of the lead characters grieving and being faced with certain problems, it didn't do anything for me. I mean, I really couldn't care about Sean Yu's character because I felt he was unlikable. And I mean, the girl, by default, because she's young and innocent and is automatically the dramatic focus. But even then, I mean, you don't feel like she's in any serious danger at points. So the follow of the story for the main section on Sean Yu's, you know, on Sean Yu's character, as I said, I wasn't really interested in his plight. I was more concerned with the girl. And then it's only when their kind of plot lines come together is when I really kind of gave a shit. But it wasn't enough for me to completely be bored with the film. Although I think there's maybe probably too much going on and not enough effort made into really kind of making that feel convincing.
Yeah, a bit too ambitious, I think. Because I thought it lacked a little in focus and emotional investment, yeah. But, you know, your opinion on that, Dave, in terms of the kind of massive plot and the emotions within it.
Yeah, it doesn't quite all doesn't all sort of work. And yeah, I mean, Zhongyu's character is, you know, essentially pretty unsympathetic. I actually think it's one of his, probably one of his better performances. I mean, he's not a, you know, I've got to say, not a sympathetic character, but I think
he's complex. Did,
yeah, yeah, he done.
He has his fingers in so much here, so I think you know it's. Don't Tom, behave. For you know, he's involved in a lot. That's what I was saying. But so it seems like, you know, the movie is not set up to you know, let's solve his character throughout 90 minutes, but yeah. there's a few things that he can do to sort of change his life, you know, be a little bit good, you know, and chance to do a little good, you know, for one, save Bonnie Sin's sister from the clutches of the hobo, because he, you know, he's going after the hobo, and then possibly he's, you know, about to be a father as well, and he might have a chance for that walk that he sort of desires, but I think we are saying there's too much in the plot. I think there's too much for the character as well. You know, it seems like these are characters partly that are on the path of doom. You know, they're kind of too deep into it. I won't say what happens towards the end, obviously.
The thing that I really like about the film, you know, above all, really, is the use of the locations and the way they're shot.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say they're made to look pretty, which, you know, be, yeah, you know, close to impossible. But they're certainly given quite a sort of a, you know, an almost kind of arty look.
Yeah, it's very green.
It was hard to decipher the director's reasoning for the green soap.
No, absolutely not. I mean, connected to the moss, obviously, but that was not something I found pretentious, to be honest. Yeah. Because I like the rough, gritty look and the grain as well, the pronounced grain. Mm. So, you know,
I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to this area of Hong Kong, Sham Shui Po. On quite a few occasions, it's.
This is not green.
the parts I went to, you know, had considerably fewer prostitutes, but it's quite a densely packed area of Hong Kong, as is it. All of it is really pretty much Hong Kong.
Cramped as hell, this.
Yeah, but Sham Shui Po is quite notable for that, and it's. Quite a kind of a working class area. It's not a sort of it's not considered a sort of a destination. You know, it's a sort of, you know, a suburb of it's kind of out the other side of it's beyond Mong Kok and out some way a little further towards kind of the airport. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a glamorous location. It's quite notable for these kind of really like densely packed shopping malls, you know, crammed full of sort of computer gear and sort of
stuff you see in like kind of games, Bio Zombie, you know, those kind of cramped shopping centers.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. But I mean, the parts I've seen of it don't look quite as rough as they do in the film. But I'm sure those places exist as well.
It looked like very little builds, you know, sets. It seems like they went on out on location quite a bit for this one. And if there is a 50-50 mix of the offset and location work, then that's a pretty seamless one. You're talking characters that I don't necessarily care about and the character relationships. In particular, the Fancy Wong, the bum and the little girl. I do care for the fact that it's nice to see Fancy Wong in this role, and that you're not kind of surprised that he could do this role, a dramatic role, after years of working, honing his craft, growing older, even honing his craft during an uneven career, you know.
Yeah.
Age hopefully gets you presence, confidence and charisma, and I think Fancy Wong showcases that despite being buried in obviously a bum outfit.
It was a bit strong. It was a bit too much, you know, like you might see in a kind of in a comedy or something. It was a bit sort a bit too much, the sort of the outfit and that. It didn't help the believability for me. No, you know, just sort of it looked, you know, a bit too much like an outfit rather than someone who's just, you know, in the situation that he was in. You know, it was a bit too kind of. It didn't help me buy into that aspect of the
but
film.
Wasn't it kind of like it was not surprising to see Fancy Wonka? It was not a forced, you know. I find good aspects, you know, of his performance. I liked his performance.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not surprised that he could do this. You know, 10 years ago, possibly not.
Yeah, I mean, the performance was fine. It's just kind of, you know, that kind of you know, big outfit, like loads of coats and the big long kind of straggly hair. It was just sort of, I mean, he himself was fine. I mean, it's kind of, 2008, 4 years ago, it's kind of when he started really coming back into film and you know, getting more kind of prominent roles after, you know, a fair few kind of semi kind of wilderness years where he was, you know, just kind of maybe, you know, working on his craft.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of the, you know, beginning of his kind of comeback, really. That's always.
And then Ip Man 1 and 2 came along.
Yeah.
Or was he in both? Or
Both of them. He was also in Connected, and he's been in a lot of stuff that I recently enjoyed. So he seems to pop up quite a lot at the moment. But I was just going to say, I didn't recognise it was him until he was actually helping himself at the dinner table. Maybe I wasn't looking close enough, but I didn't recognise him until then. But at first it probably seemed a bit too, something you'd see in a comedy film for me, like over the top. But I think he earned it in his performance. Mm.
Yeah,
he wasn't.
His performance was strong, yeah.
His performance was really strong, and then near, like, kind of as it progresses as well, I really kind of was more sympathising with his character than anyone else in the film. So I think he, for me, was the real star, because I kind of cared about what was going on with him and his situation, as opposed to Sean Hughes' character.
On Sean Hughes' character a little bit more, and another aspect that I didn't really get why I was there, didn't do anything for me, and it's the fact that he has the flu, he has a cold throughout the movie, and, you know, has a runny nose, and he's, you know, he's sick throughout the movie, and I was like, so what? That doesn't add anything to the character drama for me, that he's sick. It was not like it was leading up to a gun confrontation. He was about to pull his gun, and then achoo! It was not.
Yeah,
it was not leading up to that or anything. You know what I mean?
I thought basically for me when I first thought, I thought he was hinting at that he might have been dying. They might have some kind of disease that was going on, something with him, kind of, you know, being around all these prostitutes and being around this dirty area and kind of you know, going in and out of kind of different sounds dirty.
Yeah, yeah.
Going in and out of different, you know, a different situation. I thought, you know, it might have AIDS or something like that. He's picked up something that, you know, is killing him, and I thought that would be a kind of dramatic tangent. But it's weird you say it, Ken, because it's just never touched upon. It's the first half an hour. It's kind of three or four times it's said, and it's kind of really kind of like shown that this, you know, this guy's sick, and then after a bit it's completely forgotten.
Kind of sitting in front the air conditioners all the time, you know. No wonder you get sick. You know, these leaking air conditioners just blasting the cold air.
I think it's maybe a kind of a bit of a commentary on the sort of kind of the area, you know, that the sort of the film's set. But it doesn't really work. But I think it's kind of what they were kind of aiming at.
Yeah, because it's so pronounced that they are aiming for something, and something that didn't really work. But you know, to pull something from my old review, a little quote from my review to sum it up for me. There are indeed trees to be chopped and flowers to be grown in terms of the characters, and also including Derek Kwok in development. And that's symbolism that you easily get on board with, you know, the connection to the moss and the fairy tales and all of that. But ultimately, the dark plights aiming to be heartfelt are only solid in that department, and that is a kind of a missed aspect to the moss. You know, it's solid, but you can't criticize it for, because it clearly wanted to be more, considering how dense and all of that, and how the characters end up. But looking at it again, you know, a few years later, I'm still of the same opinion that I was back then, it turns out. So I have a few more notes, but before I do that, do you guys want to sum up the movie in any particular way?
The kind of mainland element of the story feels somewhat sort of bolted on at times. Filled entirely is kind of organic. But I mean, I love the fact that the director gives the film, you know, a tremendous kind of look and atmosphere, and is, you know, always trying to sort of elevate the material. And, you know, even if it isn't, you know, successful, you know, all the time with it, you know, it isn't entirely successful in trying to do that. But, you know, that's what I take away from the film. You know, they sort of, you know, the atmosphere of it, the, you know, the look, and, you know, the fact that he's trying things, even if they don't always come off. I mean, and, you know, the creatives behind the film, director Derek Kwok and, you know, writer Clement Cheng, went on to make, you know, the multiple award-winning Gallants, which is a film that works on every level for me. So it's very encouraging to see their you know, their development sort of, you know, in, you know, in their craft and in their you know, in the sort of their position and so, you know, level of success in the Hong Kong film industry. So
it's kind of inspiring to see young people casting old veterans and making that work in terms of critical acclaim and awards acclaim as well. I mean, it was the best Hong Kong movie. It got the best Hong Kong movie at the Hong Kong Film Awards like 1 or 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, one of the aspects. I mean, the Susan Shaw is in this film as well as Gallants.
And I think in The Pie Dog as well. I think that was either a nominated role or something she won an award for, actually, in The Pie Dog.
I mean, I really love the fact that there's been a few films where, I mean, herself and, you know, and you know, and a number of other sort of veteran actors are kind of appearing in more films now. And you kind of you look at their work, you know, in these movies, and you can really... appreciate them more when you've gotten to, you know, you can contrast their sort of, you know, approach to their craft, you know, with some of the sort of young, you know, younger, less, you know, experienced, you know, actors and actresses that are out there, and, you know, how much they can do with, you know, like a look or a gesture or a small movement.
Just look at Derek Tsang's little role in this one, you know. He's totally confident, totally... He plays a kind of a superior or a colleague of Sean Hughes. And calm, too, you know. Just super solid. And Eric Tsang is a great supporter of new talent. He was in Kwok's debut, Pie Dog. He had a terrible wig, but he was still on there. But you know, Eric Tsang and Andy Lau, and like, they're just very supportive of young talent. So it's great to see, and that they're so... You know, it's not hard to buy now. We've seen them do this for 15 years, do dramatic roles. You know, it's not hard to buy into the fact that Eric Tsang can do drama nowadays, you know, despite knowing of My Lucky Stars and what have you.
It's I guess a lot of it comes with experience. I mean, when they were coming up in the industry, you know, when they were new, you know, it was a different setup. You know, the business was different, but you know, you can see their sort of, you know, decades of experience, and, you know, they just kind of bring that to bear on these roles, and it's just you know, it's really sort of very satisfying to see.
Yeah. Any way you want to sum up the film? Any other thing you want to add about the film, Tom?
Yeah, I had a couple more notes about it. Eric Tsang is probably the most annoying ringtone known to man. if you do that, it's like this high pitched, like almost like I don't know what it was. It was quite annoying. Is it Liu Kei-chi, the actor? He had one of the most horriblest dying sequences I've ever seen. It's not a spoiler, he dies fairly early on, but...
It's a fantastic little role.
Someone give that man an Oscar. Yeah, it really played with me a bit. It was horrible. It was really horrible, where it seemed like it was almost... it could have been, like, just kind of over and done with, but they really really kind of showed it for a while, and it was quite hitting.
Very drawn out, wasn't it?
I mean, dramatically, it didn't do a lot for me, but just the visual of it was very, like, made me uncomfortable, like, how kind of, it wasn't very nice.
It's just one of the best character actors Hong Kong has, you know, small roles or big roles. I think he won an award for Beast Stalker. He plays opposite to Nick Cherry. He's been in tons of stuff, but he has a slapstick element that kind of works, because you know, he's the triad boss who's kind of paranoid about getting assassinated, so he puts on a bulletproof vest and helmet when he goes out. And yet they kill him. Fancy one shoots him, which is fantastic fun. And even, you know, slapstick elements like him running into his car and he hits the fucking door frame. And he's like, but he has his helmet on, so, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He's all right. But yeah, I just felt like, what spoiled it for me, there's moments throughout the film where it was kind of a bit too exposition-y, where characters would describe another one, like another character, or they would describe a place, or, you know, it's clearly only there to fill the audience in with information. They did it, like, not very subtle, but the bit where, sure, you said some stuff at the end, which kind of annoyed me. Again, it felt like the only reason it was there was to kind of force the audience to emote a little about it. You know, but I thought it was all a little too late. But yeah, I don't think it warrants another viewing for me personally, but it's definitely worth a rental, as I think eventually it's rewarding near the back end.
Fairly well in that regard, but not something I need to rewatch either, to be honest. So minor notes about some minor moments that kind of work. I think this was between Fan Xu Wong's character and the little girl, that he has recreated a pop-up book pages from a porn magazine.
Oh yeah,
which is, it was kind of sweet in this nasty world. Why not? You know, a design choice there. That was a minor moment, but still, you know, hey, that's kind of wrong but sweet. And you got to respect a guy like Sean Yu. His working habits I've always respected, and he's been at it and still is at it. And I don't know if he's ever going to develop into a good actor in this day and age. I think he's a good actor. I mean, if he's going to develop into a great actor, I think that might take another 10-15 years, but I hope he's going to be around for that. He doesn't seem like he has a wants to butter up his pop star image only, and I don't think he does a lot of singing, to be honest. It seems like he is of the kind of Andy Lau generation in Train of Thoughts, that, you know, work.
It's funny you saying that, because that's just what I was thinking. I was wondering if maybe, you know, in sort of years down the line, he will be kind of like an Andy Lau sort of type, who will just have worked at his craft, you know, so long and so hard. You know, not being the most, they'll have a sort of, technically sort of gifted actors, but he would have worked at it so much that, it'll be that kind of Andy Lau figure that will,
Certainly, you know, the ethic and the is there. Clearly, it is there. Yeah. I mean, he's done a ton of work, and probably can admit that he's appeared in a lot of crap movies too. And Andy Lau too. I mean, I respect someone who has professional working ethics. Clearly, it's like that. I hope he's not an asshole on set and all of that. But the work speaks for itself, kind of. Anyway. He's been around for quite a long time. I mean, and you don't have that longevity in all industries at all times. So
yeah, I mean, I see an interview with him where he's talking about he'd made a gangster movie in and around the same time as this called, I think, Wohoo.
Mokomak movie by Wong Jing, where it was Infernal Affairs times 100, because they had a massive amount of undercover cops in the trials. And I liked it, though. That was kind of good, actually.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interview with him when he's talking about that, and, they're talking about his character, and, I think they're trying to get him to sort of, talk about it at length, but he goes, it's just, he's really quite sort of modest about it. He goes, it's just like a killer and that, You know, so he seems quite, quite grand. He doesn't sort of, he's not sort of given to sort of, talking at length about films or characters that don't, it's not necessarily kind of justified, in doing so. So he seems quite fairly sort of down to earth sort of a character.
Cool. Yeah. And he's got gems on his filmography. I mean, probably the main one is Rule Number One, with the horror movie he did with Ikin Cheng.
Yeah,
which is still fantastic stuff to me, and a real dark movie and all of that. And now, you know, being in two of Edmund Pang's movies, maybe three, you know, Love in the Puff, Love in a Puff, Love in the Buff,
and
Buff,
which is now the Pang Ho Chung's most successful film ever.
So. Yeah, exactly. So so keep an eye out, and I'm glad to keep an eye out for Sean Yeo, and I hope to see him do well.
Mm.
Any more notes, guys? Otherwise, we'll round off this discussion.
No.
Other than me picking the movie for next week, and speaking of Andy Lau, we are going back to an Andy Lau movie. I don't think there's an English title on the print, but there's an English title. Two variations of the English title has appeared in posters and what have you on Laserdisc covers and VCD covers, and I'm going with the one that amuses me the most. And it's the movie called Proud and Confidence. It's mostly known as Proud and Confident, but I like Proud and Confidence a lot more. It's essentially Hong Kong's Top Gun. But it's not a flying movie, it's a training movie, yeah, but it's kind of like Hong Kong, Top Gun in Hong Kong. And we're watching that next week. Late 80s action movie. Lots of shooting. Francis M playing the Val Kilmer role. Not as homoerotic, though. although the image of you know, Dick Way appears in swimming trunks in this movie.
I'm there.
Yep, we're there. We're there next week. Looking at Dick Way in his his black swimming trunks, so flexing.
Hopefully we don't see his Dick Way.
Keep an eye out. Proud and Confidence next week.
I've never heard of that one.
It's a fun movie. New QI, Ross McQuan, it's impossible not to draw comparisons to Top Gun, but it's not overly copied. But, you know, it's from that time too, you know. So, 2 years after Top Gun, if you will. So, but it's good fun. I have a custom version that's... has more violence in it. The Ocean Shores version was cut quite a bit. Then that person combined two versions quite well, so get a lot of cool violence in this. Anyway, that's next week. Contact information again: Podcast on Fire is the show you've been listening to, located at podcastonfire.com. Email: podcastonfire@googlemail.com. Message forum, podcastonfire.com/forum. Register to access the members only archive. On the website, you'll find bonus episodes posted every now and again. And we're on Facebook, facebook.com/POF network is our fan page. And join the discussion, ongoing discussion, in the discussion group that you can just search for in the Facebook search box, Podcast on Fire Network, and it'll pop up. We're also on Twitter, twitter.com/podcastonfire. My written reviews, sogoodreviews.com, and my video reviews, lisakvideo.com. And I'm on Twitter as well, twitter.com/sogoodreviews. Rate and subscribe to Podcast on Fire Network on iTunes, and listen to us on the go with the application Stitcher at stitcher.com. And Hong Kong Gig Guide, David?
Yeah, I'll be doing some more things over the next few days, adding some shows. Hopefully a few more that I can get to, so that'd be great. If people want to pop along and take a look.
And vcinemashow.com, Tom.
Yep, Ip Man 2 review probably coming up this week, I'm guessing.
Have you done a Ip Man 1 review for that very site as well?
Yep, first review for the site, so cool. This will be the follow-up to that one.
Are you doing the legend of Ip Man, the Homer Yao movie as well? Or have you already?
I haven't, I want to see it, and I definitely probably should review it as opposed to... not review it, but yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that, and probably, yeah, it's on the list. There's a big list of stuff, so yeah, keep your eyes peeled.
Very cool. Okay, this has been Podcast on Fire 119, so this has been Kenny B, and with me was Hong Kong Dave.
Bye.
And Tom KW.
Bye-bye.
Who's also probably a fuckable lover and a motherfucker, but...
no doubt.